Welcome to today's episode. We have John Warlow. John is the founder of the Value Builder System and the author of the best-selling book, Built to Sell, Creating a Business That Can Thrive Without You. It was recognized by both Fortune and Inc. as one of the best business books in 2011. After that, John went on and wrote a book called The Automatic Customer. It's creating a subscription-based business in any industry, and that was released in February 2015. John and I jumped into this idea of Value Builder. What is it? What is this system? And he went into how it's basically a 12-step program that creates more value. And he chatted about something that I found so cool, that business really isn't about just driving top-line revenue, but it's also about value. And a lot of selling a company and growing something that means something is more about value than revenue. Anyways, super cool, goal setting, building businesses, lots of cool discussions, and we really dove into the idea of authenticity. Hope you liked today's show. Thanks for listening. Hi, and welcome to today's episode. Today we have John Warlow here. Hey, John, how are you?
Hey, good, Laura. How are you?
I'm great. This is really fun because I came on your show about a year ago, would you say?
Yeah, it's like you do mine, I'll do yours. It's good. I like it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. You have this great concept about Built to Sell, and I came in and chatted about my company, and we had a great conversation. I'm excited to hear what's going on with you. So, you know, I know last year you were in the process of launching another new book. You started and exited four companies before that. What's going on now? What are you up to?
You know, I spend most of my time at a company called Value Builder, where we work with entrepreneurs to help them improve the value of their company. We've got a 12-step process. People who end the process on average get offers that are 71% higher than the people who start the process. So it's got a real measurable way that we add some value. And yeah, I wrote the book, The Automatic Customer, really to focus in on one of the 12 drivers of company value that is kind of misunderstood and not often well executed, and that is recurring revenue, the creation of some subscription-type revenue, regardless of what industry you're in. So that's one of the big drivers of company value.
Got it. So you have a 12-step system in the Value Builder, and one of them was what you based this book off of. How did you pick that one? What was the motivation? Was that something that you just felt like was the most confusing or complicated?
I guess I'm kind of personally passionate about it. I mean, I hear a lot about from entrepreneurs kind of puffing out their chest saying that, you know, well, we did $1 million in revenue this year. We did $10 million in revenue. And it's all about kind of top line revenue. And personally, I find that frustrating is probably too strong a word, but a bit off-putting because, you know, value is very different than revenue. And so what I found, you know, acquirers really don't really think as much about revenue as they do about other nuanced elements of your business. And one of those ones is recurring revenue. So it's one thing to say, you know, we've got $10 million of revenue and they come from three, you know, custom projects we do each year, custom construction projects. That business is virtually worthless versus saying, yeah, we've got $10 million of recurring revenue from, you know, 1 million customers who pay us $10 a month or $10 a year, that business is worth like a factor of 4 or 5 times their revenue. So it's part of the book was to sort of dispel the myth that entrepreneurs should focus on at the exclusion of everything else, their revenue. Revenue is important, but there are other elements to making your company valuable, and recurring revenue is just one of those biggies that acquirers look for.
I didn't work in the reoccurring revenue space, but I couldn't agree with you more. Our company was sold based off the value, right? I mean, the revenue, again, like you said, it was important, but the idea that they could take our model and replicate it was what got everybody super excited. What a cool thing to talk about. What are some of the other 12 steps?
Oh, wow. We talk about something called the Switzerland structure, which is named after the country of Switzerland, where, as you know, they're kind of obsessed with neutrality. So we named this concept, the Switzerland structure, to describe a business that is not dependent, in other words, independent of any one customer, employee, or supplier. Mm. So you're going to want to have lots of customer diversification, not be too reliant on one key employee, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Hub and spoke is a management style that is detrimental to the value of your company. It means that you're sort of autocratic, everything comes through you type of manager, whereas what you want to do is sort of empower your frontline people. We look at financial performance, growth potential. Growth potential is a biggie because, of course, an acquirer, for them, it's the starting line. For many of us as entrepreneurs, we think of selling, and maybe you felt the same way when you sold your your company, Laura, but we think of selling as sort of the finish line, right? It's the end. It's like the end of the marathon. You limp across and you kind of hope that you don't look that bad at the end. But what for the person buying your business, of course, it's the starting line, right? So,
yeah.
So that's a real head shake for a lot of entrepreneurs. So we talk a lot about that.
Couldn't agree more, first of all. I mean, I didn't expect it. I was trying to get to the end date where we did the deal, even though I had a 2-year contract, but I did not realize that the next 2 years was the harder of the process. Mm. What do you focus on in that area, just out of curiosity?
Well, when it comes to growth potential, what you prior to selling the company, what you somehow need to do is communicate to an acquirer that there are many growth options ahead of you, and you've got lots of opportunity to grow. To use a farming analogy, there's lots of more, you know, crop to be harvested. Mm-hmm. And so we look at ways that you could grow. So we look at the classic, what's called the Ansoff matrix, which is named by a Harvard professor, which talks about the different ways you can grow, minimizing your risk. So the least risky way to grow is to sell more of your existing products to your existing customers, just get better at executing. The next riskiest is to sell new products to existing customers. Another similar risk would be to sell the inverse.
Right.
the worst or most risky opportunity to grow or option to grow is to sell new products to new customers. So we just walk them through different ways to think about their business, different products, focusing on the least risky ways to grow.
Very cool. And you mentioned this value builder system. You work with entrepreneurs. How do you find these people? How do you choose who you take on? How long is the program? What does that look like?
Yeah, we don't actually personally work directly with any business owners. We license the software that we've developed to advisors. So we have roughly 600 advisors around the world. So they are M&A professionals, accountants, business brokers, coaches, consultants who use the platform we've developed with their customers. So it's an indirect sort of go-to-market play.
Oh, I get it. So it's an actual software system. And what is it? What does it look like? What features can one expect when they see it?
Well, I mean, it's the traditional sort of software as a service. You log in through a web browser, and there are sort of three main components to it. There's a goal setting section. There's a set of action items for capturing action items. And then the bulk of it is dedicated to the content of each of the 12 steps. So for each content module, we have some explanation as to why that element drives the value of your company, how you need to think about it in your own company. And then we have an exercise or a tool that business owners go through with the help of their coach to help improve their performance on that one of the 12 elements.
I see. And do you train the coaches on how to do this?
We do. We've got a training session coming up next week, actually. So yeah, no, we train probably three or four times a year. We'll have a training session with 20 or 30 advisors that fly in from all over the place. And we train them on how to coach the model. So yeah.
Very cool. So what were the previous companies you worked with, and like what led you to this space?
You know, the one common denominator in my past has been a fascination with and a respect for entrepreneurs. So my last company before this one, we studied entrepreneurs and tried to understand what made them tick as buyers. And we provided that information back to Fortune 500 companies on a subscription basis for them to understand how to better market and sell to entrepreneurs. Mm. So our subscribers were, you know, Google, Apple, American Express, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, these massive companies that have traditionally have a really hard time selling to small companies. Small companies don't really think they understand them. And so we aren't outfitted these very large companies with information research, et cetera. We surveyed 10,000 business owners a year. So that was my most recent company. All the way going back, my first company was actually a radio production company where we produced a daily show called Today's Entrepreneur, which was nationally syndicated in Canada. We produced this show interviewing a different entrepreneur every day of the year, 5 days a week for something like 3 years, where we just interviewed entrepreneurs and said sort of, how did you do it? How did you get successful? What would you do differently if you had it to do over again? So that was where I started, and I sold that production company. So anyways, that's the
common outcome. It was this kind of then the culmination of all of these businesses and experiences and like how you would approach an ex-business? Is that how you came up with the value builder system?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's studying entrepreneurs and being one myself a couple times over, I've seen firsthand that the topic of exiting one's business is terribly underserved. There is, I mean, if you Google how to start a business, I mean, you don't need to tell me there's like millions and millions and millions of documents and white papers and books and articles. But if you look at the topic of how do you successfully sell your company, very few topics. I've likened it to or compared it to Sully, the guy who landed the airplane on the Hudson River. Remember that story a few years ago?
Yeah.
So he lands this, whatever, 737 on the Hudson River. He's like 63 years old. He's been flying for 40 years. He's a trainer for US Airways. He's done everything there is to do in an airplane. You know, every maneuver, every emergency, you know, maneuver. I mean, he trains other pilots, yet he had never had the opportunity to land an airplane on the Hudson River. And for a lot of entrepreneurs, it's exactly the same thing. We've all written marketing plans. We know how to sign an office lease. We've figured out how to hire employees, how to fire employees. I mean, we've done all this stuff because we've been doing it. The one thing we never get to practice is the exit, because you only get to do it once.
Yeah. And it's like a storm when you're in it. So there's no time to read a book or figure it out on the fly, right?
There isn't. And I mean, arguably, it's the most complicated and highest value aspect of what we do as entrepreneurs, right? I mean,
yeah,
it's...
Yeah, and you're so ill-prepared. That's such a good point. I mean, I don't think I've heard anybody say that, but right, you're study marketing before you even try it, right? You're studying and studying sales strategies, and then you try them, but you don't study the exit strategy in it. For us, it showed up, right? But some people, I guess they plan it for some period of time, but it is so difficult.
It is. And of course, one of the reasons it's shrouded in secrecy, right? So when you sold your company, you probably you signed some sort of NDA that said like, I'll never talk about it, or I'll never certainly reveal the mechanics and the sort of back and forth of the negotiation. I mean, that's common, right? Most of us have to sign those NDAs when we sell a company, non-disclosure agreements. And so even if you wanted to sort of provide all sorts of detail about the sale, you really can't. It's illegal. So there's very little information out there.
Yeah, because I don't think anybody wants to know. It kind of gets ugly, right? Like, there's a lot of back and forth. Ours went on for months. It was unbelievable.
And part of that, I think, Laura, is that the buyer is a mercenary. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean, the buyer's job, he or she, you know, gets up in the morning, 9 o'clock, and until 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock at night, their job is to buy companies for the least amount of money possible. And that is their training, and they do it very well. And many of them are very well compensated to do that.
Yeah.
And they're not emotionally invested in your business the same way you are. And, on the other side of the negotiation table is this like highly emotional, you know, person selling their baby. And this guy is kind of, or this gal is kind of going to work and, you know, just trying to buy companies for as little as they can. I mean, they leave at 6 o'clock and they go enjoy the rest of their life. Whereas most of us as entrepreneurs, you know, we seethe when they said, you know, it's not worth what we thought it was, or like we seethe for weeks and we like envision how we're going to like knock off this person on the other side of the negotiation table. But they're not as invested emotionally.
No. And to your other point, I mean, they're practiced, right? I mean, this is what they do.
Right. There's a school in Chicago, your neck of the woods, that teaches corporate development people. So these are the people to buy companies, the sort of tricks and underhanded tactics of buying a company for less than it's worth. I mean, they kind of teach these negotiation tactics. To me, I mean, it's like preying on the vulnerable. I mean, it's horrible, but it exists. And part of what makes us sort of get out of bed as a company is trying to right that wrong, is defend the entrepreneur who is going to, frankly, get taken advantage of if they go and try to sell their company to one of these mercenary buyers.
You know, I fashion it a lot of times. I don't know how I'd love to hear your opinion on it, but to the real estate market, you know, as a first-time home buyer, I felt very similar to selling my company, just in a very small way, right? Like it's much, much more extreme and much more emotional. But, you know, when you're buying and selling houses, people are very emotional. And the first time it's just this absolute mess. You don't know what's going on. And, you know, you figure it out by the second or third time. But, you know, often people are selling their company one time. I mean, do you see it similarly in that the real estate industry has the agent who's been through this day in and day out? And like, you know, sometimes the buyers and sellers are just whirling around.
I do. You know, business brokers and M&A professionals hate the analogy that selling a business is like selling a home, because in some ways it belittles their profession. And I get that. I understand why, you know, they go to school, they get an MBA, and then they're basically compared to a retail real estate agent whom they believe don't necessarily have the same degree of pedigree or education. I kind of get it. But for me, I think it's the best parallel. I think it's absolutely on point, because it's got all the emotional overtones of selling a company. Selling a house is very similar. I mean, even something as simple as, I mean, we've got young kids at home, right? So my wife hates the process of selling a house for obvious reasons, right? You've got to keep it perfectly tidy, you know, for anybody who possibly might show up one day. And so your entire life revolves around selling the business. And after like 3 weeks of showing your house, you're like, I don't care who's buying it for what. Just get me a check and get me out of this house.
Right, right.
And
right.
The same is true in a business, right? You've got to constantly keep your business perfect. You've got to keep the employees at bay and make sure they don't know the people touring the office are actually thinking of buying and not doing an audit. I mean, it's just this constant dance. So I think there's tons of parallels.
Yeah. I totally hear your point. And it's a really fair one to value a company and all these different things. It does take a certain amount of education, but it is very similar in so many ways. So, I mean, John, you've started and exited 4 companies, 2 books, you've got the Value Builder System. How do you think about the next thing you're going to do? Is there something, do you have a list of things that are always on your mind and you just keep ticking through them? Does it come to you next? Like, what's that process for you?
I am certainly not a list. And it seems to be a bit more iterative in nature. I wrote a blog post years ago called Life in 10-Year Chunks. And what I tried to communicate in that blog post is that as entrepreneurs, we have a tremendous luxury that people who go to work for a bank or choose to become a police officer or a doctor or a nurse simply don't have. And that is the opportunity to live life in 10-year chunks, meaning you can start a business, grow it, sell it, and then take 2 or 3 years off and then go do exactly the same thing again. If you go to work at a bank, you simply can't step off the career ladder for 2 years and then expect to walk back onto the ladder at the same point in your career trajectory. You simply opt out and then you will flatline in that business, right?
Sure, for sure.
If you're a doctor, you've trained, you've got student debt up the yin yang, and then you all of a sudden decide, oh, I'm going to stop being a surgeon, you know, for a couple of years, you lose your skills, you know, the half-life, et cetera. And so as entrepreneurs, I think we have this, there are many, many disadvantages to being an entrepreneur, but this one benefit I think is one that we should celebrate, and that is that you can pause and nobody cares. You know, frankly, you're only as good as your next idea. Whether you take 2 years off, 2 months off, or 10 years off, if you've got those skills, that ability to see a market opportunity, market it, fill it, build a team, etc., it doesn't matter when you apply them. And so I guess I think a little bit like that. So my last company I sold in 2008, and we moved as a family, my wife and our 2 young kids at the time, they still are young, but they were even younger, to France. We lived in a village called Aix-en-Provence for 3 years. We put our kids in a French school. I did a little writing. I did lots of cycling, and I didn't really worry about the career path per se. Mm. And then when we came back from France, I kind of ramped up this business. And, you know, frankly, I'm probably 2 or 3 years into another 10-year run, right? So I'll exit out of this business in the next 5 or so years and probably take another couple of years and do something unrelated to business. And again, it's one of the tremendous benefits, I think, of being an entrepreneur.
I love that you say 10-year chunks, because I feel as if, I don't know what your sense is, and I'd love for you to respond to this, but I feel as if there's so much on the internet right now that makes it look as if it's a 1 and 2 year chunk. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, you throw a website up, you have this idea, bang, 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 sold and onward. And I just don't believe there's very many, most things take a while, and it's traction, and to build something good takes a while.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think there's so much, you know, I've had the opportunity to do a little bit of writing for some of the magazines that I think popularize that idea that it's, you know, 36 months to exit. And
yeah.
And I know that, having a glimpse into the editorial side of those publications, I know that you know, part of the conversation is what's going to look sexy on the newsstand? What's going to be like a really cool story? And what's something that people can identify with? Guess what? Some plumbing company that creates a turbine in a plumbing, you know, that's a boring, brutally unsexy business. But if you sell shoes to new moms, that's a great story. Let's get that on the front cover. Mm-hmm. So part of it comes down to the stories that we all hear about are the ones that are sexy new technology or sexy new business to consumer products, yeah, which people can identify with, right? Airbnb, I mean, Tesla, all these stories are of brands that we can consume as consumers. But I couldn't agree more. I mean, I just interviewed yesterday, in fact, the ladies behind Mabel's Labels. Have you ever heard of this company?
Yeah.
If you've got kids, you probably know all about it. If you put a sticker with your kid's name on a sippy cup, that sticker probably came from Mabel's Labels.
Right.
Go ahead.
It's a big name in this space.
Yeah. So the woman who started that, along with three other friends, it was four of them as founding partners, started that business 13 years ago and built it over a 13-year run and ultimately sold it just a couple months ago, actually, to Avery. They sold it for $12 million. And so what that will play out in the press is, you know, Mabel's Label sold for $12 million. And every one of their friends will think, oh my gosh, that she, you know, they just started Mabel's Labels just recently. And now they're walking around with $12 million in the bank. Well, actually, it took 13 years of not taking a salary, you know, sacrificing, frankly, a lot of personal friendships, time, you know, family connections, et cetera, to put the time into that business that was required to get it to be one of the darlings, one of the true success stories. And they sold it for $12 million divided by four. So they walked with $3 million after, before tax, over a 13-year run.
Yeah.
And that's the home run story, right? For every home run story, there are...
And if you take that fourth of a paycheck for each of them and you take the taxes out and then you divide it by those years.
Yeah.
Because they weren't taking big salaries, right? And you say, what would they really paid over the 13 years, right?
You're right. And again, I'm not suggesting it's not a success story. It's a tremendous success.
Of course, of course.
Great company. It's a wonderful story. The women are driven, ambitious, smart ladies. But to your point that, oh, it's just like an overnight success and they, you know, all of a sudden have $12 million in the bank. It's not that simple.
No.
I
started my company before the internet was a big deal and, you know, dates me a little bit, but, and there's so many drawbacks. I think the internet is just phenomenal for business owners nowadays. But the one thing I feel is while I'm doing my new project now is there is so much fronting right now and the way people set up and the stories that are told, it feels like everybody's successful overnight. And, you know, I think I love hearing you say that and that you've been behind the scenes with it and talked to so many people. And that's just been my experience as well. And everybody I've spoken to, it takes a long time. It takes a lot of heart to stick with it.
The worst are the information publishing people. If you go to like the information products conference about the motivational speakers, the 10 easy ways to create a business, I mean, all of that ilk, it's brutal.
Brutal.
And there are just tons and tons of examples of people that, you know, and frankly, we're all human beings, right? Like good marketers have decoded the way our brains think. And we know we're motivated to avoid pain more than we are to seek out opportunity. And they unfortunately have found a way to program so that, you know, a lot of these programs can be purchased based on marketing sort of spin. And I'm not suggesting they're all terrible because clearly there are some that are tremendous value, but that's a tough business to watch market themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm totally with you. So John, a part of this podcast and what I ask all my guests, you know, and you fall into this category, you've obviously had so much success in your career. But what has it meant to you to have not just the external successes, but a life that also is meaningful to you? And so what does an authentic life mean to you?
That's such a big question. I feel like I should be on a couch, horizontal, like rubbing my brow, thinking pensively about this question. Look, I don't know if this is the answer you're looking for, but...
I am an agenda here.
No. Okay. All right. So the first thing I do every morning when I get up is I pour myself a ridiculously strong French roast coffee and get a bowl of cereal and I open my laptop to Evernote. And I have this Evernote that I publish, I write on every morning, and it's a gratitude list. And it sounds corny and cheesy, but I literally sit there in a half-dazed fog, all the things I'm grateful for that morning. And so when I look through the list, again, I write the same stuff every morning. You think, hey, John, you could probably get over writing the same stuff. You've probably done that. You could tick the box and get on to something more useful. For whatever reason, I do it, and it centers me or makes me feel in some way aligned, balanced, ready to take on the rest of the day. So it's things like I'm grateful that I have healthy kids, that I have a loving wife, that I've got a, you know, and it's not material possessions very rarely. Sometimes it'll like French roast will trickle onto the list and I'll be very grateful that I've discovered a certain kind of coffee. But usually it is the relationships, it's the health. And so I don't know, that's probably to me what makes me tick and maybe makes me able to live an authentic life on some level, if that answers your question.
Yeah. Yeah. So having not just this successful life, but all these things that you're grateful for as part of it, right? Like a lot of people define it as you've sold 4 companies, right? But I think you know enough people who have done the same things who are quite unhappy.
But you know, it's funny. If I look at that list, and I'm candid and honest with you, occasionally what will come onto that list is something like, I choose to work, I don't have to work. Or I get to pick my projects, or I get to pick my schedule, or I've chosen an office building, which is about 1 kilometer, 1/2 mile from my home. So I don't have a commute. And all those things, while they sound not material, they actually are on some level material, right? There is a material component to that, meaning there has to be a level of financial whatever, wherewithal, freedom, so to speak, so that you can make those decisions to have that flexibility. So I don't want to sound so holier than thou that I don't care about those things. I clearly do, but it's not because I can then go buy a certain material object. For me personally, it is very much so that I'm deeply motivated by personal freedom. I even see that in the political discourse right now. I mean, the candidates that resonate with me politically are ones that are not trying to place too heavy a burden of government control on me. And I mean that both right wing and left wing, but also socially and liberally. So I find it equally disturbing when a political candidate wants to tell me how I need to live my personal life as I do when a political candidate tells me how, you know, that they want more than 50% of my salary after tax, because I find both of those things equally reprehensible. So, you know, having personal freedom is just a very deeply motivating thing for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I think these are the things that getting clear on, you know, what matters to you, what doesn't matter to you. And it's not just about buying, like you said, another material object, is what creates a life that has meaning to you outside of just your job. And was this something, you know, the personal freedom and the clarity on not having a commute and all of these different things, was that something that you have always done? Or was there a point in your life where you had a turning point and you said, okay, got to make some changes. I'm not doing this, you know, in a way that feels right to me.
You know, when I was a kid, I grew up with a dad who was in the publishing world. So he was a publisher of magazines and newspapers. And as a result of that, he had lots of superficial friends. And I don't mean that to suggest he was a superficial guy. Here he is a superficial guy. I just mean that in the publishing world, everybody wants to be your friend because everybody wants coverage. And it's not genuine friendship. It's sure. They want coverage of one way, shape, or form. And I remember when I first got into business for myself, I tried to leverage my dad's personal contacts to get a head up. So, you know, if I wanted a customer, I would ask my dad for, does he know anybody at XYZ company? And I remember one time I'm embarrassed to even tell you this, in the sense that it's an embarrassing way to start in life, but that's the way I was wired from, you know, when I was 21 or whatever. And I remember we went to see one very large company, Canada Post. So the large, it's like the USPS, and a multi-billion dollar federal corporation. And I remember we went to see, I think it was like the president or some senior guy there. And my dad walked me down there to this guy's office. And I could tell pretty quickly into the meeting that the only reason I was sitting in front of this guy was as sort of a favor to my dad. And I remember walking out of there feeling so personally sort of ashamed that I couldn't do it on my own, that I somehow, like, I wasn't going to get this contract with Canada Post. He had, as a favor to my dad, you know, met with me, but there was no way that what I was asking for, we had no business being in front of this guy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the only reason I was there is because of a personal or nepotism, essentially.
Yeah.
And I remember leaving there thinking, I'm done with that. I am never going to basically rely on my dad's connections in order to do something in my life. And it's always stuck with me. I mean, again, this is 25 years ago. This is a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
But it feels like recent in the sense that it still motivates me now to forge my own way. Even when I make mistakes, I know that I screwed up, as opposed to, you know, I can't blame anybody else. So.
Yeah. So making it on your own and having that personal freedom are like two drivers. Yeah. That's a great story. I love it. And you already mentioned that your daily practice of taking a list. Do you have any other practices or habits to manage the stresses of a life with so many things going on, so many successes? Or some people meditate and go long walks. Is there anything else?
I do yoga.
Do you?
And I work
you?
Out. Yeah. And, I do have the habit of getting one big, hopefully creative project done before I go to the office. So I work from home for the first hour in the morning. After I do my gratitude list, I just try to pick off the one project before the kids wake up and the chaos starts that will make the biggest impact. So usually that's some sort of creative project that I'm working on, an article or a presentation or something. And I try to get that done, because then once I get to the office, it's mostly sort of meetings and stuff like that. So I don't get a chance to be creative once I'm in the office. So that's kind of a habit that I try to stick with. And frankly, not to be too sycophantic, but I have a great team here, and they do a lot of the heavy lifting. So it does free me up to be there for the baseball games and the tennis matches and stuff that my kids are involved in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so funny. There's a book, Daily Habits of Writers, I believe, but it's just the daily habits of Woody Allen through to, right? Like, you know, even Voltaire or somebody from a long time ago, but so many of them woke up and started their day with their creative stuff. Cause I think you lose it later in the day, or you're too tired.
Well, I don't have that 1 or 2 hour block that of uninterrupted time to just kind of go. And the moment I sort of pull up and look at an email or respond to a text message or something, it takes me 15 more minutes to get back into that trance. So for me, that first, I don't know, 30, 45 minutes of the day is probably as productive as the next 8 hours.
Yeah.
In terms of value.
Incredible. Yeah. Well, John, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was incredible. If people want to hear more about your Value Builder system or either of your books, where can they find you?
ValueBuilder.com.
ValueBuilder.com. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Laura. It's been a pleasure.